I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you'll hear the second part of an interview with journalist, attorney, and author Andrew Craig. Andrew Craig has done extensive research on the JFK assassination and in September of 2014 participated in a conference on the 50th anniversary of the Warren Commission report. C-SPAN covered the event, and you can see and hear Andrew Craig's speech by going to the C-SPAN website and searching for Andrew Craig and the Warren Commission. And Craig is spelled K-R-E-I-G. Andrew Craig wrote the book Presidential Puppetry, which came out in 2013. He's got a new edition of that book coming out in February. He also runs a blog, which you can access by going to the website justice-integrityproject.org. In addition to the many great articles and research on the site, you'll also find a very well-organized guide to the JFK assassination, which I encourage you to check out. So let's begin with the second part of the interview with Andrew Craig. We begin here talking about the media.
And the other and maybe most important point, Cheryl, for your listeners, is that we think of the news media as the watchdog and as distinct from the power. And maybe that's true when on most stories that are trivial and so forth. But when you get to the most important stories, the media is part of it. And my latest book, for example, traces the ownership of the Washington Post. And once you take a look at it, you realize that the Graham family, it's more of a banking family than a newspaper family in its roots. Catherine Graham's father was chairman of the Federal Reserve Board. He was chairman of the World Bank. And at that level, the newspaper is just one of the things that he was doing. And as recently as about a year and a half ago, the Washington Post was only making 4% of its money from circulation. So if they did break a big story and everybody goes out and buys the newspaper, that really doesn't affect their bottom line hardly at all. And they were making their money from other purposes. And if you look at those other purposes, it becomes almost like the newspaper is, in part, the public relations arm for the other enterprises. And that's even more dramatic now because the founder of Amazon.com bought the Washington Post 14 months ago for $250 million. Approximately a year ago, Amazon got a $600 million contract to handle advanced computing for the Central Intelligence Agency. So let's think about this. And this is documented. In fact, the Washington Post has mentioned this, typically a sentence or two every few months. But think of the implications. You have the major news organization here at the Capital Region is part of a larger entity that's helping the agency run its advanced computing. And then you've got the database of Amazon.com, which has everything that everybody's buying from the middle class on up. And so they've got all of our records. Now, in defense of all of this, they'd say, well, look, the old Post wasn't making any money, so this is an infusion of new money. And it's all separate because Amazon's over here, Washington Post is over there, and the CIA is in a third place. But if they're all being, it all is going through the same ownership, in a sense, it's not that different. And think of the incentive for the reporters at the Washington Post to kind of pull their punches writing about the CIA. Now, they would say, oh, we just won a prize from reporting on the Snowden surveillance stuff. So we're very aggressive. But here's what I would respond, and thank you for giving an opportunity to talk about these important issues, because there's very few other places that anybody talks about this at all. But here's how I would respond. This prize process is like a good old boy network here. You know, the fact that the Post won a prize doesn't make up for the day-to-day ongoing conflicts of interest here. That if you're a smart editor at the Washington Post, you're going to know that they have been tied in with the CIA for many years and with the banking community. And while you may do some stuff, you're not going to be talking about the kind of things that you and I are talking about right now.
Right.
They've had plenty of opportunities to do it. They've got lots of reporters, and they don't go near any of this stuff. And the Roger Stone book on Nixon that I just mentioned puts a whole new cast on Watergate, for example. And briefly, his view of it is that Nixon did not authorize break-ins. People were doing this stuff, and he was certainly culpable of many dark deeds in his past and cover-ups, but that some of this was orchestrated to take him out. Because if we go back to the beginning of the program, Cheryl, where Stone mentions that Nixon had hired Jack Ruby.
Right.
Well, think if you're Nixon and you see the killing of Kennedy. And what Stone explicitly argues, and by the way, he's not alone in doing this. There are other books on this. He says that Nixon knew immediately that the CIA was involved in killing Kennedy, and that after he became president, he wanted to get the files from Richard Helms, the CIA director, who refused to give it to him. And that helps illustrate this larger point. We think the president is in charge of all this stuff, but if he can't get the files, the murder of a predecessor, how powerful is he? And that the more he nagged the CIA about this stuff and they realized that he's trying to get the goods on them, the more people who said, look at this guy, he's opening the door to China, he's talking with the Soviets, we're in the middle of this Vietnam War and he wants to phase down the war. And these kinds of things provided, in Stone's well-argued view, a motive for taking out Nixon. And again, you know, we hear endlessly, including with the death of Ben Bradley, about the heroic watchdog journalism role. And I'm sure that most of the people working on the story looked at it that way, but they may not have, and almost certainly didn't know, the overall plan. It's like a play. People have a part they're assigned to play. Oh, you be the investigative reporter on this. And they do their job, but they don't realize what the end of the...
Right, they don't have the big picture.
Big picture.
Now, Amy Goodman has documented that there's over 400 and I think it was 25 CIA agents working in the corporate media. And I know you've done some research around that. Have you come up with similar conclusions?
Well, yes. In fact, I've quite extensively studied that. And in fact, my column yesterday talks about a very important figure in this. His name is Fletcher Prouty, who helped place these kinds of operatives, not just in the media, but also in the military and elsewhere in the public and private sectors. The number is unknown. My hat is off to her if she can quantify it quite that precisely. I haven't seen her or heard her story on that, but here's what I would suggest. The definitions are a little bit elastic. So, for example, just now you used the term agents. Well, that has a very specific meaning in the intelligence or law enforcement context, and typically it might mean somebody who actually gets a salary and maybe even has some kind of badge or something. But it's also got a secondary meaning of just someone who's cooperating. And so, in a sense, one might bring in a second term, asset. An asset might be, and that's the more typical way that the CIA works with the news media and elsewhere, is to have an asset. And that way, you don't have to give people a badge and a salary, because that could, in covert work, that could lead to problems. So it's more of a situation that they might get someone's spouse a job, a well-paying job, and so they don't have to give the asset a salary. But everybody knows that the job comes with loyalty. Maybe in the news media that they just give them great leak stories and exclusives. And so no money changes hands. It's just implicit that you're only going to get the stories that allow you to continue your job if you more or less do what the agency wants. And that's a huge problem throughout Washington, not just with the CIA. People at the White House quite often do not dare ask sometimes even the simplest questions for fear that they'll be looked on as dangerous. So, for example, in my presidential puppetry book research, in trying to understand why is it that President Obama is hiding his school records, I asked the bureau chief of a major newspaper, why don't you just ask for the records? And she said, well, Rahm Emanuel, the chief of staff, wouldn't like that. And I said, so what? She said, well, you don't want him mad at you.
And
that's the kind of control mechanism, that if Rahm Emanuel was upset with her, he might call up her boss and chew her out, or maybe she wouldn't be invited to the Easter egg photo opportunity or something like that. Partly joking, but I'm most serious. But she might not get the interview granted for somebody that she's asking for. And that could be, in this environment, she could lose her job just for irritating somebody by asking, what's the big secret about President Obama's college records?
Right, so there's a culture of don't go there, and people learn what it is, and that they avoid it out of self-protection.
Another example, this time I'll invoke CNN, but these are more conversations that I've had, so I'm not using all the identifying information here. But CNN White House correspondent said that she asked a question at a press conference, and the White House chief of staff, again, it was Emanuel during the Clinton administration, said, see me in my office, like she was, you know, some school kid and he's the principal. And so she goes up and he launches into a tirade against her. And she goes back to CNN and according to her story, mentions this to the bureau chief, who says, well, don't antagonize them. And so sticking up for her, it's her fault.
Yeah, see how that works. So you talk in your article, and you spoke about this earlier in the show, about how we need to go back to our history with the JFK assassination to understand what's going on in the present. I understand you've been doing a little bit of research on Syria, and maybe you could talk about that a little bit.
Well, yes. Just, I think it was November 15th, there's a big front page story in the Washington Post. U.S. weighs increasing CIA aid to Syrian fighters. And it says accelerated training and weapons assistance would fill the gap as Pentagon program take shape. Well, here we have the CIA, which was created as an intelligence guide to the president, yet again getting involved way beyond its mission in war. And this is something that President Truman wrote an article that everybody should know about, although very few people do, right after the Kennedy assassination. And the headline was, Control the CIA. He was basically saying, I created the CIA for one purpose, to advise the president on intelligence. Here's the headline. Limit CIA role to intelligence, by Harry S. Truman, December 22nd, 1963. He wrote that he wanted it exactly a month after the assassination to say this agency was not created to go all over the place and be conducting wars and propaganda. That's basically what he was saying.
And it's so expanded now. We have like 16 intelligence agencies, don't we?
Right, right. Yeah. So instead of listening to him, we're relying on the CIA to run war in Syria. That's the kind of thing that I mean, that we need to understand history. It wasn't created to do that. And regardless of whether it had this role in killing Kennedy, this is standing our democracy upside down, to have an agency that Nixon can't get their files on the Kennedy assassination. And now we see the fruits of this on the front page of the Washington Post.
Right, and Congress ordered them in the 1992 Act to release the documents, and they don't follow congressional orders either.
Right, and now we've got this standoff between the head of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Dianne Feinstein, who has been a huge supporter of the CIA throughout her career, but she and her staff have a report that's critical of them, and that report cannot be released because the CIA doesn't want it released. And President Obama and his minions are too worried about antagonizing the CIA to just say, cough it up. The U.S. Senate is supposed to exert oversight over the CIA, not CIA exerting oversight over the Senate.
Right, and this is sort of what those new books that came out about the deep state or the double state are talking about, correct?
Yes, and the only reason that this can exist is that the public remains unaware of it, and the reporters won't report it, and we have isolated examples of courageous individuals who know about this and who have stepped forward. One of those people I quoted in my article today, which is headlined JFK, November 22nd, and the Continuing Cover-Up. One of those individuals was this Fletcher Prouty, who had a unique position in all of this, in that he was a colonel in the Air Force, and he was the top liaison between the Pentagon and the CIA during the Kennedy administration. He had also had a similar post during the Eisenhower administration. And he wrote one of the first tell-all books about this, and it was called The Secret Team, and it came out in 1973. And in it, he described huge dangers in what he called this kind of secret government. He says that the primary loyalty of the secret team at the CIA and in its moles throughout government, including the White House and Congress, is as a kind of permanent private sector servant to the oligarchy. Mm. Now here's a direct quote. He says, quote, membership on the team, granted on a need-to-know basis, varies with the nature and location of the problems that come to its attention. The power of the team derives from its vast intra-governmental undercover infrastructure and its direct relationship with the great private industries, mutual funds and investment houses, universities, and the news media, including foreign and domestic publishing houses. The last part here. The secret team has very close affiliations with the sources of power in 60 foreign countries, and is able, when it chooses, to topple governments, to create governments, and to influence governments almost anywhere in the world.
Wow, that's a great and powerful description of what's really going on.
And so this is from Fletcher Prouty, who later wrote a book called JFK, in 1996, and he laid out the reasons why the CIA orchestrated the killing of President Kennedy. And so when people criticize conspiracy theories or any of this talk, I have a question for them, Cheryl.
Yeah, please ask it.
What kind of evidence is sufficient here? Here we have Fletcher Prouty, who he was right there. He knew these people.
But see, I think the problem isn't, they're not looking at the evidence. They don't know about Fletcher Prouty because CNN isn't telling them about it, or Fox News, or the newspapers, and so they don't know about him.
And most people don't have the time or the inclination to seek this information out.
Well, that's a huge part of it. I just spent some time with family members who have young children, and I just saw just how busy people are trying to get through the day and find the little joys, particularly at the holiday season, and avoid the vicissitudes and just the crushing obligations of getting through the day. And thinking these big thoughts is an incredible luxury that actually I didn't even have when I was in the newspaper business or actively pursuing my work as a lawyer. It seems related, but reading these 500-page books, people don't have time to do it. And one of the things that outrages me currently, and this is a university station, and I always loved WWUH when I was in Connecticut. It's the main one I listened to, and I love the Mort Figa jazz show. He passed away, but I still remember a lot of your hosts. But one of the things that outrages me is how some of the prestige professors around the country and universities are part of the system. And in the quote I just read, he talked about how the CIA uses universities and the news media and so forth. But that's not our perception when we have things like tenure protection and so forth. And it's supposed to be professors in the spirit of Professor George Michael Ivica who are taking the lead on this.
Right.
But instead, I see almost all relevant professors backing away from this stuff. And you've got to think, well, what's the point of studying history and having your professorship and your tenure protection if you're not going to help the public understand what's going on?
Now, Andrew, I think you're one of my heroes because, as you talked about Fletcher Prouty being one of those kind of people who is digging into this and revealing the truth or the deeper politics there, you're doing the same thing in your book, Presidential Puppetry. And you have a new edition coming out. Maybe you could talk about that for a moment.
Well, thank you. Yes, there will be a new edition in early 2013. And something unusual is going to happen there. I've not seen anybody else do it, but I think the situation calls for it. The new edition will be expanded to cover the recent developments in the election and take a closer look at the 2016 presidential candidates. I think it'll be Jeb Bush in all likelihood, possibly Mitt Romney, or maybe even both on the Republican side, and of course Hillary Clinton. And this kind of historical look really needs to flesh out what's going on with them. But here's the unusual part about that, is the book is going to come out in a portable version of about 200 pages at the same time that the 500-page version comes out with its 1,000 footnotes and endnotes. Here's the concept, and I'd be curious what you think of it in the abstract, Cheryl. Most people are too busy to read a 550-page book, including its 1,200 endnotes. I think people would like to know that everything is authenticated and they could pursue it if they have time, but realistically, they don't. And a lot of young people have told me, just tell what's going on. We'd like to know that it's true, but we don't have time to go through all this. And it's not just young people. Everybody's busy. So my thought is, if they're advertised, one is the portable, concise view that just gets to the point about what's going on now with a little bit of history. But people who want the whole nine yards, they can get that too. What do you think, and have you heard of anything like that? We're all trying to look for the right solutions to fit the right times. So what do you think?
I haven't heard of anything like that being done before, and I think it's a great idea. It'll certainly get the book and ultimately this vital information into more people's hands, and I think that's the goal. And, of course, the documentation will be there for anybody who needs or wants it.
So I think that's a great idea. Now, when do you expect that to be released?
We're shooting for February.
Okay. I know, Andrew, we've talked about we're trying to reschedule our canceled November 19th event that you were going to be here for. So for the listeners, Andrew will be coming here to speak sometime in February, but we haven't arranged the date yet, so we're still working on that. And looking forward to having you come, Andrew, and do that. Is there anything that we haven't talked about that you'd like to mention before we pause?
Well, I think the main thing is we're facing some of these foreign affairs struggles in the Middle East and in the Ukraine, potentially very serious dangers for the public, I believe. And it may seem remote to people, but there is a very powerful constituency in the U.S. that wants to commit troops and just push the possibility of war to the limit in both of these regions. And I think the listeners should really read carefully about that, because it's very hard for the news media right now to be covering these battles and dangers. There's two reasons. One is, in much of the Middle East, you just can't get people on the ground, so you're hearing things only from allied governments, and that's a problem. And the other thing is, there's a huge unintended consequences. For example, if you go right doorstep and have quite vehement protests about how they have no right to do this or that, there could be pushback that could get out of control. And I don't think people are thinking about that. I think it's very difficult, for some of the reasons that we've mentioned, for the news media to cover this kind of thing. Another problem, I think, is just the level of animosity in Washington between the Republicans and the Democrats. And no matter which party one's sympathies are with, it can't be good for our country and democracy to have this high level of animosity and the potential for a stalemate.
The confusion there for me, Andrew, is when they get into power, they follow the same policies. Nothing changes. So that's always very interesting to me, that there's all this animosity, but then we get the same policies no matter which party is in
control.
Well,
that I think goes to the concept that, in a sense, they're both working for the same masters who may differ on things like gay rights or immigration policy or, you know, some of these social issues. But ultimately, there are ways that they're forced to fall in line. Because it's a public official, even though it's a private conversation, maybe I'll mention it, but about 6 years ago, when I was more in the private sector as a business person than a reporter, I happened to share a small plane from Washington to New Haven with veteran Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro. And I sat next to her, and I had a lot of things on my mind from reading the papers. And I still had some sources, and I gave her some good information. Toward the end of the flight into New Haven, she said, "You've got to do something about this." And she was actually quite concerned about what I was saying. And I said, "You're in Congress. I mean,
right.
I'm trying to earn a living. I'm giving you the information." But I thought it was funny, if it weren't so serious. You bring something to them about major problems, and I forget what it was, but it was probably some of the stuff we're talking about. And she says, "I've got to do something."
Right. That tells you something. Well, Andrew, I'm sorry, unfortunately, we're out of time, but thank you very much for being on the show and sharing your wealth of wisdom and knowledge about all of this.
Oh, thank you for the opportunity.
And that concludes the interview with author Andrew Craig. His website is justice-integrityproject.org. And now I'm going to end the show by repeating the Fletcher Prouty quote from his book, The Secret Team, that Andrew read earlier in the show. Because to me, that says it all, for both the past and the present. So here it is.
Quote, "Membership on the team, granted on a need-to-know basis, varies with the nature and location of the problems that come to its attention. The power of a team derives from its vast intra-governmental undercover infrastructure and its direct relationship with the great private industries, mutual funds and investment houses, universities, and the news media, including foreign and domestic publishing houses. The secret team has very close affiliations with the sources of power in 70 foreign countries and is able, when it chooses, to topple governments, to create governments, and to influence governments almost anywhere in the world."
This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.